Border Patrol agents can create checkpoints and board a train or a bus, all without a warrant, as long as they're within 100 miles of the nearest border.
Literally everything that is 100 miles in off of any coast, anywhere, is considered to be a border zone.
That's Ed Yanko with the ACLU of Illinois. He'll join us. Plus, the U.S. doesn't have enough veterinarians in rural areas, and they are critical to preventing disease and our nation's food supply. Here's vet Karen Chandler talking to Harvest Public Media.
Every day that I'm out here at the sale barn on Thursday mornings, my thought is, would I want my niece to eat this at school? And if I don't think I'd want my niece to eat that at school, it doesn't walk through our sale room.
And we'll recap the latest in state politics with Illinois Public Radio's Brian Mackey and Tony Arnold from WBEZ. That's all coming up on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. Coming up on today's show, veterinarians are crucial for the safety of our farmers and for our food supply, but there aren't enough of them in rural areas. Plus, later on in the show, we'll get our weekly state politics update with Brian Mackey from Illinois Public Radio and WBEZ's Tony Arnold. But first, in the year and a half since President Trump took office, we've been hearing about how federal authorities have been more aggressive in detaining and deporting unauthorized immigrants. You may have also been hearing more terms and phrases around the issue, whether that's ICE, sanctuary cities, or family detentions. But there's another important term that you should know about, one that you may not have heard of. It's called the border zone. It's an area where Border Patrol agents can get on buses and trains to search for people without documentation, all without a warrant. And as it turns out, most people in the U.S. live within this area. To help us understand this, I'm joined by Ed Yanko, Communications and Public Policy Director with the ACLU of Illinois. Ed, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Liz. It's really good to be here.
So, Ed, I gave just a very brief intro into what the border zone is, and I myself am new to this term, new to what it means up until recently. So I'm wondering if you could expand on what it is and especially why it might be surprising to folks like myself hearing about it perhaps for the first time or just starting to learn about it.
So I think one thing, when we hear the term border zone, I think most of us, especially in light of recent events, you know, think of it as being about the areas down on our southern border, say, you know, around communities like El Paso or San Diego or someplace like that. What this actually is a power or authority that the Customs and Border Patrol maintains or asserts that comes from the 1946 Immigration and Nationality Act, which was interpreted by the federal government in 1953 to expand a border zone to include 100 air miles from any border, you know, including water borders. So literally everything that is 100 miles in off of any coast is considered to be a border zone. So that includes, you know, the entire state of Florida. It includes, I think it's upwards of, you know, like two-thirds of the population of the United States. And here in Illinois, it includes both the entire city of Chicago, but also, if you think about it, from the Indiana border just south of Champaign-Urbana, you think of an arc that kind of goes up to, you know, west of Rockford, quite near the kind of the northwest corner of the state of Illinois, all of that is covered by this border zone that CPB claims to be able to act in and act in this way to conduct random and arbitrary stops and searches in terms of looking for people and things that might be in the United States without permission.
Well, and Ed, I think that is the most fascinating part because everyone in Illinois, you know, we're a landlocked state. We're nowhere near any kind of coastlines or any kind of international borders, certainly. And that was the most surprising part for me. But before we take a deeper dive into how that even came to be, you threw out some terms in there. And I want to make sure that we have all of our terms clear here because I myself kind of struggle with this. The agency that we're talking about is the U.S. Customs and Border Protection. You just mentioned CBP. BP or Border Patrol agents, but we've also been hearing a lot about ICE in the news lately, and that's Immigration and Customs Enforcement. So what exactly is the difference between the two?
Sure. So ICE is the bureau that was formed after 9/11 when Homeland Security was created. ICE is the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which is tasked specifically with enforcing immigration laws in the United States. And so that particular entity is, you know, relatively new. It's within, you know, 15 or so years old, and is an entity which is specifically tasked just with immigration. Customs and Border Patrol has a little bit of a broader, I would say a broader kind of docket, in that it really looks at both what is coming into the United States, not just in terms of human, you know, bodies and human human beings, but also it has a wide array of control over materials and goods and merchandise and that moves into the United States. Of the two, in terms of human movement between the border, when you come into the United States, the first person you meet is someone from Customs and Border Patrol. Okay. If you take a trip outside of the United States, when you come back and present your passport, that person is a person from Customs and Border Patrol. It's not someone from ICE who is checking your immigration status.
Okay, so two quick things here. Has Border Patrol, I know you said it goes back to the 40s and the 50s where this was kind of established, but has Border Patrol, A, always had this kind of authority going onto these vessels, trains, buses, without warrants, or is that a new thing that they have enacted? And kind of go a little bit more into the recent history.
Yeah, so the Customs and Border Patrol, or the agents and various agencies, have always claimed this authority within the border zone, going back, as I said, to the 1940s. Periodically, over the years, we've seen them exercise this authority in a series of ways. The general way in which you would see it happen is that somewhere directly near an international border, either near the Canadian border or the Mexican border, Customs and Border Patrol would set up an actual immigration checkpoint, and they might check people as they come through there. That tended to be the way in which this authority was exercised and demonstrated most directly. Within the last couple of years, and certainly during the Trump administration, what we've seen is a much more aggressive use of the authority in a couple of different ways. First, I think in the one you mentioned, is that we've seen, you know, an uptick in the number of times, I shouldn't say an uptick, but a massive increase in the number of times that they have actually boarded trains and buses and other conveyances that move people away from border areas, and check people or begin to move, like in the bus situation, from row to row and check people to look at what it is that, you know, whether or not asking questions about their citizenship or their immigration status or et cetera. So that's one way that we see it. The other way that we've seen it is that in addition to checkpoints along areas around the border, you'll see increased numbers of times where Customs and Border Patrol people are actually making traffic stops based on whatever standard they're using. They will actually engage in the practice of stopping someone just the way a typical law enforcement officer would, in a driver and the passengers in the car, and then conduct these kinds of stops. So that's essentially what we're seeing.
Right. So what's also been making the news a lot recently, and I think people need a lot of clarification on, including myself, this idea of detaining someone, in particular detaining families, whether that be together or separate. Under what circumstances, under these rules or under this authority, can Border Patrol actually detain someone within the border zone area? And has that changed recently?
Right. So that let me start by saying one thing, which is this authority that the Customs and Border Patrol claims and utilize in this way is something that is largely untested and largely unseen or unchecked. This in the 1946 law that created this, there was literally there's literally no legislative history of discussion of it, and no one has ever really looked at this question or raised this in a significant way. But in terms of the detention of people by these things, the thing that has not changed is that an immigration official or a Customs and Border Patrol official cannot detain you or your family unless there's some sort of reasonable suspicion in order to do that. And reasonable suspicion is a fairly low standard. It's not probable cause, just in the that. But it's certainly not just someone having a hunch or a gut feeling.
Okay.
There's some specific thing that an agent has to know about you or your family in order to detain you
So, Ed, I'm
in
curious, do you
that
have like a real
circumstance.
life example that could give us an idea of what you mean by circumstance or?
Yeah, I think your example earlier about someone coming onto a bus, I think really does kind of offer this. So a person comes onto a bus, or an agent comes onto a bus and begins moving row to row, and they ask a person for their ID, and that person appears to be someone, speaks with an accent, has, let's just say, a Latinx surname. They're asked for ID, they produce it, and the officer says, "Tell me your, show me your proof of citizenship." The person has a driver's license or a state ID of some sort. They say they don't have their proof of citizenship, and that is not reason to take that person into detention because they don't know anything specific about that person. They've just come across them in this set of circumstances, number one. And number two, as a U.S. citizen, we're not obligated to carry our proof of citizenship with us wherever we go.
But Ed, are you finding or are you hearing that that has become the case, that has become a circumstance in which they do detain someone where maybe in the past that hasn't been enough, but are you hearing that that is enough now?
It is a concern. I would not say in all of these examples that we've begun to hear about planes or whether it be trains or buses or other kinds of stops, we aren't hearing a great deal about that. I will say that on the border where they've been more aggressive in terms of the kinds of car, auto stops and routine kind of checks, we are hearing more reports of American citizens who get caught up in those and are detained. Now, those frequently, when you hear those stories or when they pan out, end up being just for a few hours. But frankly, no American citizen, should be taken into detention for any period of time, for no purpose.
So what kinds of advice do you have for people who are perhaps aboard these buses or trains or vessels? They're stopped by Border Patrol officials. They don't have their proof of citizenship with them, but they do have some sort of ID. What kind of advice do you give? Because oftentimes, we've been told that people's a well-known right for us as U.S. citizens is to remain silent. But does that pertain here? I mean, like, what is their course of action if this is happening?
It's a really good question, and so the first thing that we, often remind people is that even in that zone and even under these circumstances, that you retain that right to remain silent or to tell the agent or someone else that you'll only answer questions in the presence of an attorney. And by the way, you can do that whether you're a citizen or non-citizen, whether you're documented or undocumented. You don't have to answer any questions about anything, including your immigration status. And so, you know, oftentimes that's the, you know, that's the big piece of advice, you know, that we give to people. If you're asked for documents, you know, sometimes or often what you need to provide may be different depending on what your immigration status said. As I said, you know, if you're a U.S. citizen, you don't have to, you know, you don't have to carry proof of citizenship. Mm-hmm. If you have valid immigration documents, they may well ask for those. And so it's one of those circumstances where the very best thing you can do is to just exercise that right to wait and to have an attorney present before you answer any questions, especially if you think, you know, you may have any kind of legal jeopardy.
Yeah. Well, Ed, I apologize. We are out of time, but I want to thank you for your time and for your insights. That was Ed Yanka, Communications and Public Policy Director with the ACLU of Illinois, joining us to talk about the border zone. Thanks so much for tuning in to the 21st. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. If you ate meat this past 4th of July, you have a veterinarian to thank for making sure it was safe. Vets and farm communities play a critical role in making sure that the nation's livestock are free from diseases. But for years, there haven't been enough vets in hundreds of rural counties across the country. Esther Honig reported on this issue recently for Harvest Public Media. She's based at KUNC in northern Colorado, and she joins us from there. Larry Firkins joins us in the studio. He's an Associate Dean of Public Engagement at the University of Illinois College of Veterinary Medicine. Esther, Larry, I want to welcome you to the 21st, and thanks for being here for this conversation.
Thank you, Liz.
So, Esther, I'd like to start with you. Before we talk about this vet shortage in a more broad sense, I was hoping that you could tell us a little bit more about one of the veterinarians that you spoke with for your story, Karen Chandler. She's originally from Orlando, Florida, but is now a vet in a town called Brush, Colorado. So what does she do every day? I believe we're going to have to get back to Esther there. So, Larry, can you give us a sense what it's like here in Illinois? What do rural vets do for our state?
Yeah, I would be happy to. I was one of the rural veterinarians from 1986 to 1995.
Okay.
I was a partner in a practice in central Illinois. We were about 90% food animal. That was split about equally between cow-calf and pigs.
Okay.
One of the enjoyable things about my time in practice is, well, we did schedule things in advance, routine processing, herd checks. Also, every day was different in that the emergencies that came in. We did about 10% small animal. I could leave in the morning and not be sure exactly what time I would get back with the emergencies that would come in. We were responsible for individual animal care. We worked with dairy cattle, we worked with beef cattle, and then we worked with several swine operations doing both emergency work and then preventative work. In the spring and fall, it was very common that we were doing obstetric work, delivering calves, performing C-sections if necessary, dealing with any type of illness associated with baby calves, whether it was respiratory or diarrhea type deals.
Okay. And Esther, I know that we just got you on the line, so you may or may not have heard a lot of what Larry was talking about there. But in your conversations with Karen Chandler, the vet that you spoke with, how did that differ, if at all, from her day to day?
So, you know what, she drives a ton. She's constantly on the road. She has this big white pickup that she just, you know, really puts a lot of miles on. She might drive as far as, you know, 100 miles away to nearby states. If it's a real emergency, though, she has to be there within the hour. She definitely works late nights, 12-hour days. If a cow gets sick in the middle of the night on the weekend and it's a client of hers, she needs to respond. That's a part of this responsibility. So it's definitely one of those jobs that you can put in a lot and you can burn yourself out. So she has to, you know, work to kind of put up some barriers to try and, you know, maintain her personal life. But, you know, on a day-to-day basis, she might be out on a ranch vaccinating calves and then, you know, the next day she's at a sale barn reviewing cattle before they're sold for slaughter. So her job just is, you know, kind of all over the place. She's doing, you know, a lot of different things. And she's constantly, another thing, she's constantly on her phone. She's looking at emails. She's looking at text messages. She is, you know, responding to questions from her clients. They might send her photos of, you know, something that one of their cows has, and they need to know, you know, is this something I can handle? Can I buy the medicine for this? Or do you need to come out here and help me take care of this? So she's a busy woman.
It sounds like it. And Esther, from your reporting and looking into this issue, this is not a new issue. Actually, there's been a short of vets in the across the country, actually, for the past 15 years. In particular, though, here in Illinois, there are 21 counties affected by this shortage. So I want to look at the other side of this. So what is the effect of this shortage on farmers and what they do on the day-to-day? Esther, I'm going to go to you first.
So from the producers that I talked to, this shortage really puts them at they have an uneasiness about their access to a veterinarian. You know, a lot of them rely on these guys on a weekly basis. You know, from the folks I talked to, one farmer said, you know, you find a good veterinarian, and then chances are they're always busy. You know, if you can't get someone in, you know, if your cow is having trouble giving birth and it becomes an emergency, you have just an hour to get one of these guys out here to try and help save these animals' lives. So it can be really dire. On the other hand, though, you also have, you know, preventative measures. You know, the latest in medical practices that if someone can't get, you know, a veterinarian out to their farm, they might just kind of, you know, continue to do things on their own, take matters into their own hands. And that just means, you know, some of the best, you know, resources aren't being utilized for their herds.
So, Larry, I'd like to go to you and get a sense if you can, from the education side, working with the College of Vet Med, what's behind this shortage? What are you finding the reasons?
I think there's a couple things. Number one, the AVMA has been looking at this and has published several articles on it. One that I was looking at the other day was from last year, and it said the most common geographic area that new graduates look at is one that is similar to the one that they grew up in.
Okay.
We are having, we produce about the same number of cattle and pigs in the state of Illinois, but fewer and fewer producers are producing larger numbers. So part of it is we have a decreased number of farm-raised applicants.
Okay.
Now I want to make sure I don't get the impression that only individuals that have a background in agriculture would make good food animal veterinarians. I've worked with over 3,000 veterinary students during the time I've been at the university since 1995. Absolutely, some of the best veterinarians we have right now had no background or experience. The important thing we try to do at the university is to provide them with the opportunity, if they're interested in looking at food animal or mixed animal practices, with opportunities that they can shadow veterinarians. Mm-hmm. Veterinarians are becoming very aware of the issue, of the challenge that they've got of getting young veterinarians to look at their practice. They are providing stipends. They're providing housing. for externships following their first or second year, where they can go out and spend significant amounts of time with the veterinarians to mm-hmm. see if that's the type of lifestyle, to see if that's the type of practice that they're interested in.
Well, and Esther, I want to stay with this idea of finances, wages, student debt, getting things covered, as Larry was mentioning. They're such a huge part of this. So what are you finding in your research as far as finances and factors going into the shortage?
So a lot of what I found was that it is, it comes down to finances. It comes down to money. Rural vets can expect to make between $60,000 to $70,000 a year, and that might seem pretty good, but it's about as half as much as what they could make if they were working in a major city at a practice that serves small animals, so people's mm-hmm. pets. And they have $140,000 on average in student loans. Sorry, $143,000 on wow. average of student loans. So that is, I know, personally, as a millennial, I can empathize with the feeling of graduating from college and just feeling this huge burden of, I owe so much money. How do I pay this back the fastest way possible? Because, your life really isn't yours until you can take care of this. So, a lot of students look to, how can I get this off my back quicker? And it's not entirely, the shortage of rural vets isn't entirely due to a lack of interest, at least from from my reporting, what I found. The dean of the dean at the Colorado State University School of Veterinary Medicine, he told me that, at the beginning of the year, he has 30% of students show interest in working in rural areas and working with livestock and poultry. But by the time graduation rolls around, that number is down to less than 10%. And he thinks it has a lot to do with, wanting to pay back those loans. But another factor of that is cultural. And some students who came from rural areas are maybe now more interested in living in a big city where there's, more amenities, there's more things like, a diversity of restaurant choices or, big concerts that come to your city, all these things that maybe, young adults want to take advantage of. That's what he saw as a big part of, the shortage.
Well, and Larry, to that point, what are some of the most important things when you're talking to your vet med grads or soon to be grads? The most important things they're looking for in terms of jobs. And on the other side, Illinois practices, when they're trying to attract new grads, what are they doing to entice them?
Sure. The veterinary graduate debt level is very significant, mm-hmm. and we're working on strategies. The USDA, you mentioned the underserved areas within the state, mm-hmm. The counties. There are three areas that if a graduate applies to work in one of those areas and serve those areas, the USDA has a veterinary medicine loan repayment program that mm-hmm. they will reduce payment. They'll make your payments of up to $25,000 for 3 years,
okay.
as long as you serve those areas for 3 years. The Illinois Farm Bureau has a program that if you're willing to work in rural Illinois serving agricultural areas, mm-hmm. you can get a low interest rate on up to $40,000 to pay back in 5 years. In terms of the university, what we're looking at is exposing students. Our curriculum, the second 8 weeks that they're in the veterinary program, they spend that in clinics. We also have 8 weeks within their second year that they spend in clinics. Part of that is to expose them to the variety of opportunities that they have within veterinary medicine. One of the things I enjoy doing is serving as a piece of conduit to network between veterinary students and graduates, veterinarians looking to hire. The veterinarians that are looking to hire, as I mentioned earlier, are taking steps to bring new graduates into their practices earlier after their first or second year, providing them with housing, providing them with stipends, providing them with opportunities so that they can get a handle on what is an average working day like. And there's no such thing as an average day, but if you get a chance to work for weeks or even for during the summer, you can get an idea of what the rewarding aspects are of private practice in the rural communities.
Right. And I do want to get to that sense of reward or meaningfulness in this line of work here in just a second. But Larry mentioning the loan forgiveness program, Esther, I believe Karen Chandler, who you spoke with, and to note, she is originally from Orlando, Florida, now working in Colorado. That's something that she was able to get. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And I assume that that has helped her immensely. But could you speak to how she finds this work meaningful, why she chose to do it, even outside of the finances being forgiven or not having to stress about that so much? She seems to really enjoy the work and find meaning in it.
Yeah, you know, one of my favorite quotes from her, which I didn't actually get to use in my story, was, you know, I don't get to drive a nice car, but I get to work with cows every day. So she just has this, you know, just this passion for working with cattle that she's had since she was a young girl. It was a fascination of hers. And you get a sense talking to her that she's just grateful she gets to be in this position. You know, she sees herself as more than a cog in a machine. She's a part of something much, much bigger than herself. She gets to be a part of this community that is Brush, Colorado, and she really values that. She hasn't come from a small town, but she loves, like, the small town politics, the community that's there, and she really feels like she is serving, you know, the heart of America with these producers, these, you know, very genuine folks who are doing their best to keep their family business going, raising cattle, and it's something that she's really passionate about and she feels really good about doing.
And Larry, not only from working with students, but you yourself said that this was a career that you had in the past. So what meaning did you find in this line of work?
Yeah, a couple different directions. Number one was the impact that you felt like you had on the family farm, that you got to know the families. We may be processing calves all morning, get back in the truck, and there's 2 dozen freshly baked cookies in there, or there's a dozen ears of corn or a dozen tomato plants. And I thought I could pull the cookie deal off, that I would enjoy those for several days until one of the farmer's wives asked my wife what she thought of the latest cookies that she gave. And I hadn't been telling my wife that I was getting those cookies. The next time I worked cattle at that farm, there were 2 bags of cookies, one with my name and one with the family's name on it. The other aspect is, in the state of Illinois, we have about 5.5 million pigs, about 1.7 million head of cattle, and over 5 million head of poultry at any given time. Agriculture accounts for about $19 billion impact on the economy at Illinois. Foreign animal diseases, diseases that can be spread very rapidly. There was a disease in the swine industry that up until 2013 had never been in the United States before. When it arrived, it killed about 13 million pigs. That's a responsibility that the rural veterinarian has of recognizing that something is different, that this is not typical signs that I see, and then reporting that up the line. Illinois has a wonderful state veterinarian, Mark Ernst, who is very in touch with the importance and the how rapidly we need to respond if we have an introduction of a foreign animal disease. Mm-hmm. The veterinarian is absolutely on the front line of that.
Well, and I know that I myself, I think of vets in the terms of small animal at-home pets, because that's how I've interacted with vets in the past through my life. So thinking about them in terms of keeping my food safe seems very logical, but not something that I think about as I'm preparing any kind of food or anything like that. So I'd like to get a sense for you what your priorities are in terms of increasing more rural vets, right, and to make sure that our food supply is safe.
So the increased number of rural veterinarians, within the application process, we have areas that we will give preference. We'll give acknowledgement to individuals that have a farm background, that have exhibited a clear interest in food animal production, that have been in 4-H, have been in FFA, have been in various undergraduate programs, that the interest is sincere. The second thing we do, as I mentioned, is with the curriculum, is expose them to the opportunities that they may not have been thinking about if they're from one of the suburbs of Chicago, that they get a chance to interact with both our food animal curriculum, our food animal practitioners, and then the practitioners throughout the state that have got an opportunity for that. As far as the food safety, I've had a chance for since about 2001 to work with the Illinois Department of Agriculture on bioterrorism aspects, and that's extremely important.
Absolutely. Well, we've been talking with Esther Honig, reporter for Harvest Public Media, and Larry Firkins from the College of Vet Med here at Illinois. I want to thank you both for joining our conversation today. Coming up, more on state politics. Stay tuned to the 21st. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. Well, the 4th of July holiday might have been right in the middle of last week, but there's still plenty of state politics news to get to. Governor Rauner visited Champaign-Urbana to apologize for some negative comments he made about the area. Also, he and Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel got into a political spat over some protests in Chicago this past weekend. And there are also now officially two more candidates on the ballot for governor this fall. As we do every Monday, we are recapping the week in Illinois politics. Brian Mackey is Illinois Public Radio's state reporter. Tony Arnold, is political reporter at WBEZ. Both of you, of course, welcome back to the 21st, and thanks for being here.
Good to talk to you.
Okay, so Tony, let's start off with some Chicago news from this past weekend. On Saturday, residents marched to protest gun violence and poverty in Chicago's neighborhoods. And before we get into some of the political news that happened after the fact, could you lay out for us where exactly those protests took place and what happened on Saturday?
Yeah, as you said, the protest was several thousand people who took their march onto the Dan Ryan Expressway, which runs from the south side of Chicago to downtown. And, these are marchers, many of whom had been touched in some way or another by gun violence, whether they lost a relative or a friend or knew of one. And their objective was mainly to obviously get attention, but also, an act of civil disobedience and shutting down an expressway with their bodies to make the point that more needs to be done to address Chicago's gun violence. They were led in part by Father Michael Flager, who's kind of he's a Catholic priest who has a very large church on Chicago's south side and is known for having a lot of protests. They were also joined by Reverend Jesse Jackson. And as the march went on, they were even joined by the superintendent of the police department in Chicago, Eddie Johnson.
And just to be clear, too, you mentioned this, but the Dan Ryan Expressway was shut down, but just for about an hour, and no arrests were made during this protest. But in the moments following the fallout, so to speak, somehow this turned into a Twitter argument between Governor Bruce Rauner and Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel. So could you give us a sense of what happened there?
Yeah, as you said, the expressway ended up being shut down about an hour. Before that, as protesters and the organizers of the protest had talked to public officials like Chicago's mayor and the governor, they agreed that you can have kind of a lane of traffic, and then we'll put some trucks in the other lane to insulate you guys from the traffic, but we're not going to shut the whole expressway down.
Okay.
Eventually, so many people got on there that they ended up shutting the whole thing down, which is where this Twitter beef came from between Governor Rauner and Mayor Rahm Emanuel. Governor Rauner calling this chaos on Twitter, and Rahm Emanuel saying this was a peaceful protest to delete your account. Where all Twitter beefs go now is, or all beefs between politics now go on Twitter.
Right.
I don't know that it didn't look like chaos. The police looked like they had control of the situation the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
I even saw photos of protesters shaking the hands with police officers who were there insulating them from the traffic afterwards. So it seemed like, as you said, no arrests were made, and I think that the inconvenience to traffic was fairly short-lived.
Right, and it seemed like it was peaceful, right? Like there wasn't anything untoward about it. It was a protest, and there wasn't any reason for it to get like this, seemingly.
Right, and I will say that before the march happened, if you looked on Twitter, Governor Rauner's Twitter account and was getting a lot of criticism for allowing this to even go on. It seemed like there were a lot of forces specific to Twitter saying, I can't believe you're going to let this happen. They shouldn't be doing this kind of a protest. And curiously, I saw, in other protests that have happened, I've also seen people say, well, this isn't really affecting my life. Now that it's on the highway, it seemed to affect people's lives, and which is the whole point, I think, of the protest. Rauner was getting some criticism, which is maybe why he addressed this as chaos as it went on, to kind of get at the people who were giving him some flack on Twitter. But once he did that, then he was getting it from the other side saying this was all peaceful and and we moved on with our lives after like 1 o'clock on Saturday afternoon.
Well, and Brian, speaking of Governor Rauner and criticism, I'd like to switch gears here just a little bit. Last Tuesday, he paid a visit to Champaign-Urbana. And normally, we're not going to talk about every single visit he makes, right? Because he is the governor. He travels around the state a lot. But this particular visit made headlines, especially here in our community and around Central Illinois. So why was he in Champaign-Urbana?
It really goes back to something he said on a Chicago radio station. He was on WGN, commercial radio station in Chicago, in late June. And in an interview, he was trying to make his usual case, which is that Illinois is not a great place to do business. And only if the legislature would only take up his agenda, it would become a better place to do business, at least. And he started talking about Champaign-Urbana, and he was talking about college towns and in other places like, Boston, where you have Harvard and MIT, and a lot of people stick around there and build companies, or Stanford and Silicon Valley. He was saying that U of I, it's a great research university, but, in Champaign-Urbana is a nice town, but it's really hard to keep a company of more than six people there. He said, quote, there's no convenient transportation, not much of a workforce, and it's very hard, which drew the ire of a lot of people in Champaign-Urbana, obviously. Right. And he has had a number of public appearances at companies there in town, sort of touting the growth there. And there are obviously a lot of university people who have, created their own businesses through the university. There's a research park there. This sort of tapped into a difficulty the governor has had throughout his tenure, which is how do you sell his message, which is Illinois is terrible and I'm the only one who can fix it, with also being the governor and wanting to say we're a good place to do business and Amazon, please move here, and other companies, please move here. So he ended up going there. And as I understand it, he was riding around on one of the MTD buses.
That is correct.
I made this comment on a show last week. Having gone to the U of I and lived in a dorm at 4th and Gregory there, I can assure you that there are many, many buses that go through Champaign-Urbana, because I think just about every route that crosses the campus passed in front of my dorm window. This is something that people took personally. He ended up going on what some called a bit of an apology tour.
Well, and we were seeing criticisms on both sides of the aisle, correct?
Yeah, I mean, and this is the challenge that the governor has. On the one hand, he, in order to get this message out about Illinois needs to do better for business, you have to beat up on the state's business climate a little bit. But on the other hand, he wants to take credit for the good things that are happening. And we have heard from Republicans both in this case and in the past saying, the governor should really ease up on his criticism of how terrible Illinois' business climate is, because it's, it may suit his political message, but it doesn't necessarily suit the well-being of the state overall, as it's trying to lure companies like the Amazon HQ2 and other things.
Well, and Brian, I wonder, because you kind of started to reference this and then we moved past it, but we're getting deeper into campaign season, and it's hard not to notice that the Republican and Democratic candidates are both very wealthy gentlemen from Chicago. So, Brian, I want to go to you first and then follow up with Tony. What do we expect to see from both candidates as they try to relate to those of us outside of the Chicago area?
Well, I think it depends on the candidate. J.B. Pritzker favors fleece vests. Governor Rauner favors Carhartt jackets. I mean, that's one way they try to appear relatable. They shake hands. The governor rides his motorcycle. These are very wealthy people. These are the people their party chose in part, if not, because of their wealth, right? This is, we've heard a lot of talk in the past couple of weeks since the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in the Janus decision that weakens government labor unions, which have been a big fundraising source for the Democratic Party. We've heard a lot of conversation about what are the Democrats going to do? Well, we have the answer in Illinois already. They're going to go with a candidate who is a billionaire in his own right and can counter the lack of, so if AFSCME takes in or is able to give a few $1 million less in future political cycles, well, that's pocket change to somebody like J.B. Pritzker. The candidates will continue. I mean, they are who they are. We're going to continue seeing stories about strange business entanglements they have, because you don't get to be a billionaire or near billionaire in the case of Governor Rauner without things that don't look good in campaign commercials. But this is, this will certainly be fodder for many television ads in the months ahead.
And Tony, did you have anything to add there as far as relating to those of us outside of the Chicago area?
I think Brian just put it best at how he ended, which is the way that they're relating to people is through 30-second TV commercials, which they can afford to bombard the airwaves on not just TV anymore, but also on, I don't know, I've seen them on Facebook and YouTube and Pandora and just about everywhere. Because they can afford it. And this is so the way that they relate is how, you know, they choose to present themselves in these 30-second ads to people, because that seems to be about how most people are going to be getting any information about this race outside of programs like this that we're talking about, because they, as I said, they can afford to be on the air as much as they want to.
Well, and Tony, speaking of the governor's race, we still have about 4 months until the election where we are going to see Rauner trying to go for that reelection. Of course, as you guys have mentioned, his main opponent is Democrat J.B. Pritzker. But in the last week, I think, two more candidates have officially gotten their names on the ballot. So we have State Senator Sam McCann, who's running as the Conservative Party candidate, and Cash Jackson from the Libertarian Party. So what can you tell us about these two candidates and what kinds of issues they are going to be running on?
Well, I'll begin with Sam McCann, simply because he has been elected before. As you said, he's a state senator representing the Springfield area. He has a lot of state of Illinois government employees in his district and is being supported by actually a union that's been throwing a lot of money into his campaign as he's getting it off the ground, and I think just trying to get any name recognition outside of his district. He's running to the right of Bruce Rauner. I think that the idea is that he can try to be a little bit of a spoiler and drawing votes away from Rauner. In particular, McCann and Rauner have had bad blood since Rauner really came onto the scene 4 years ago. They've just plain not liked each other. And McCann votes in the interests of unions, and Rauner very much acts against them. But McCann's one part, and then you also have, as you said, Cash Jackson, which is that's Cash with a K, who's the Libertarian candidate, and he's been talking a little, just in the little bit that I've seen, about sort of the, you'd call it the men's rights movements, about making sure that men have equal rights as women when it comes to things like child custody and legal proceedings and things like that. As far as how third parties have fared in Illinois in the past, not well. In recent memory, Rich Whitney and the Green Party got 10% in 2006. And the Green Party didn't even field a candidate for this coming fall. And then I think before that, I was just kind of looking it up before the show. You have to go back to like 1986 when Adlai Stevenson left the Democratic Party because it was getting hijacked by some, extremists.
Mm-hmm.
And he ran as a third party candidate for governor. So it's they don't have a huge success record in Illinois.
Well, and Brian, we just have a minute here left, but I wanted to talk briefly about the biggest challenges that third party candidates have, which is sometimes just simply getting on televised debates here in Illinois. So historically, how has that gone?
Well, typically, these are private events, right? So just because you make it on the ballot, you don't necessarily get invited to a debate. And that's probably okay, because you would have a lot of fringe candidates. You know, you would never get the main contenders enough time. But, you know, we really don't know yet how that's going to go in this particular case. Will there be polling to say if, you know, you have to poll at 5% or 10% in order to get on the debate stage? Mm-hmm. That's a challenge, because not as many groups are doing polling anymore. It's very expensive. And as the media landscape has shifted, media organizations are struggling, like the Chicago Tribune, for example, just doesn't maybe do the same number of polls that it used to. And then the other thing is the candidates can call the shots. We saw a downstate televised debate was canceled when J.B. Pritzker decided he wasn't going to attend.
Right.
So if the main party candidates say, well, we're not going to go if this guy is going to be on stage, then that could pull the plug.
That's our state politics rundown with Brian Mackey and Tony Arnold. I want to thank you both for joining us. That's sadly all the time we have for today. For more info on today's show or how you can join the conversation, you can always visit our website, 21stshow.org. We are produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montecilio. Tyler Panlilio is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks so much for listening.